This is an extremely uncomfortable chair for a man with my ass. Could I please have a chair that does not make my ass feel as if it was in pain? Thank you.
I'm fine with mine.
Yeah, well, you are a slender young gentleman, not an ogre like me. So, did we see actually a single real star in the film?
Yeah. There is maybe 99% made-up stars and maybe 1% real stars.
So what is actually then, historically speaking, the problem with stars?
Historically?
Yes, because we have seen now more than 500 images of stars that are obviously created. So why did people feel the need to create stars? Or why did they do that?
Basically, you have to do that as moving image cameras capture stars, but not enough, so that they're not light sensitive enough, which means if you set up any camera with 24 frames per second, then you come up with 10 to 20 stars, but not with a really starry night sky. I just continued, right?
Yes, please.
And so to... that was good. To recreate the impression of the starry night sky that we have with our perception, with our really light-sensitive eyes, you have to recreate that image that you know from your eyes, but maybe not from what the moving image camera can record. And then you have to come up with a special effect, a drawing, a superimposition of a number of images, a picture, anything that you have seen right now, and then it gets to become an interpretation, and that's what I got interested in.
Actually, with what star? I mean, can you basically pinpoint it, or was it really more suddenly the realization of a concept like, damn, these stars?
No, I was studying with Harun Farocki at the Academy of Fine Arts in Vienna, and we watched many, many films, and we watched many of those a number of times, so we repeatedly watched them, which I really love, because you start to analyze and dissect the images and the films themselves, and you see their mechanisms and their bone structure and how they were made. So this was a very beautiful experience. And one of the films was Stromboli by Rossellini that we saw. And there is one really dramatic scene where Ingrid Bergman wants to escape the island at the very end of the film, and she's totally desperate. The volcano erupts, and she's in tears, and she prays to God. And there is the image of the starry night sky, which is very beautiful, but at the same time, those stars are very chunky and really large, and you realize, okay, they were just some kind of image that they put in there as a placeholder for, I don't know, the image of the stars that we had. And then I started to think about how other films are representing that image that should not change, basically, over the course of thousands of years. At least the constellations shouldn't change that much. And still, even though this picture is it's transforming through time. And then I got interested into those different trends of visual culture and musical culture and soundtracks and stuff.
So how did you actually tackle this Herculean task to basically find them? Because, I mean, let's face it, we are talking sometimes here about shots that are not even like 24 frames long, not even a second at times. Maybe a few like that go like, and they are gone. I mean, so...
Can you do that again with your hand? Wow. I like that.
That's actually quite lame in comparison to the shot I'm thinking about.
No, the shortest ones are just a 24th of a second. They're really just an image, a still image even. And first I realized, okay, I have to find many, many, many. And I, of course, started with my own memory. And also I still watch a lot of films, obviously. So I started to just make a list, and then also ask friends of mine who are cinephile and who are really deep into watching films and also have this kind of visual memory, because some people watch three films a day but they don't remember that very image, and others don't, but they can give you a list of 50 films and 40 of them are accurate, and you can just pick the starry night skies from them. Then I put in science fiction genre that's is taking place in space, completely all the films with aliens, all films with the telescope. I started to go through poster collections and see if there's Starry Night Sky in the background of the poster, which is a very common topic, but then at the same time it also promises a lot of... The promise is real. There is Starry Night Skies in those films advertising themselves with Starry Night Skies on the posters. So I wrote a huge list of about 2,500 films that I had to watch through with a couple of helpers, luckily, to finally find these 550-ish that I have there.
I mean, one thing that I found now watching it again and actually also reading my way through the end titles again, quite surprising. Where is the Star of Bethlehem? I mean, tomorrow's Easter. Where is it? There's one.
No, there is a couple. There is... you saw one in the beginning of the film with a...
Yes.
Do you remember the one star in that film?
Yeah.
I mean, there's one... It has one a circle around it.
I mean, there's one that looked rather Bethlehem-y. Yeah. But
there is a number, yeah. All the films of Jesus, yeah. The whole that story is in it, yeah. I had to.
So what did the film have to do so that you basically could not use the image? So what did you not want to have in the image? To give but one example, a film I was at first wondering why isn't it there, is Powers of Ten by Charles Eames.
Powers of Ten always have that square there.
Exactly.
So I didn't want to have anything that frames the Starry Night Sky. So there is also many beautiful Méliès films that I did not want to include because I just wanted to have the clear Starry Night Sky that is not obstructed by any spaceship, landscape or tree coming in from the side to make that image comparable and not to let us distract on moons or planets or anything like that. So I just wanted to be strictly on that clear image, the background of the landscapes or the ultimate background maybe.
So basically it would also have been, let's say, not permissible if, let's say, the shot would have been from planet Earth. We see a few trees at the bottom of it. So that was already a bit too much.
Yes, I cut it out. I cut the scene before and after. So no. When the camera is moving or when the camera is panning and something appears in the screen, at the moment that thing appears, we are being thrown to the next film. And the thing is also why you saw so many jump cuts is because I used so many of the end titles and credit sequences where you have the Starry Night Sky as a background and then you have the titles fade in and fade out and there is few frames in between and you can use them and put them into and make a new rhythm out of the credit music of Star Wars or stuff like that.
Actually, one of the things I also was surprised about, I would have basically bet that at the end of every Star Trek film, they would say, to boldly walk, to boldly go where no man has gone before. Is this really only once under a starry sky?
Yeah, usually you have that spaceship in front.
True.
On top, yeah.
True.
And then it goes...
Yes. So it's basically, how did you then structure your, let's say, selection? I mean, you would have been able to... I mean, did you actually ever think about really having it in a comparing fashion, yeah. similar skies by each other or any kind of structure like that?
Of course, I started to think about this project in 2009, so I had a lot of time to think about different ways to make it. Also, I had many different versions. And to compare it, you know, they are so different from each other that, of course, I can make groups and like camera motion, which goes this way, that way, shots that are clearly made from Earth, shows pictures that kind of accurately depict some constellations, or there is many ways to think about that. But then I found it most telling to put them in a chronological order, as you've seen them now, so from the beginning of cinema until today, which means that it's a film that is historic, but also contemporary, or it should end in our present. And in the beginning of my work on that film, I thought I can make a rough chronology by year, which means that I could just shuffle around the bits and pieces in a way that I can emphasize on something, like, as you say, you know, like make maybe some tension or just by ordering them create some kind of comment or notion. And then I realized this is maybe not the best way. So I found out the more historically correct version would be, as I did here, just find out all the premiere dates of the film and put them in a day-by-day chronological orders. So we really move through history of film and see how those stars have been shining up on the screens of the cinemas. And this makes more sense for me.
We basically were discussing yesterday that this actually went into hours at times when you had films that were premiering on the same day.
Yeah, there's two films on the same day. And I had to look up the festival catalogs to find out which one was really first. But you know, you can freak yourself into that big time. And I think I did anyway, but tried not to lose control of the real reality, whatever that should be. But you know, I think it makes sense because some films influenced each other. And of course, in the course of years, you have there's a line connecting those depictions of Starry Night Sky. So when there is a new image of the Milky Way, for example, put out by NASA, many, many films incorporate that. And then you have suddenly the Milky Way on a couple of shots just behind each other. And a couple of other shots behind each other, there's lens flares. So you can see that there was this trend. And of course, also how the aspect ratios are changing. And it's I think, richer or more accurate. And for me, it was more important to create this system or the concept of the work as tight as possible. So it's not about my decisions, because, of course, this is it's so much my film in a way, but also I'm not making any of those images. But still, I just wanted to create a system that I can follow on my own.
I was actually wondering, when you were basically looking for the films, how much did the technical aspect play into this? Like, for example, I don't look at this film because it's only available on DVD and there's nothing to download that's better on the internet. So stuff like that.
Basically, I wrote down every film on my list because this film is in its actual state. I wanted to release it when it's 90 minutes. Because this is the source, what it's coming from, the source length of the feature films vaguely. And I will also continue to work on it, so it will get longer. And I decided to only use HD footage or 2K or 4K images so that it looks good on the bigger screen, because I didn't want to make a comparison between low-quality video and high-quality video. Because then you end up with a film that makes the historical films look bad, which they actually did never. Maybe they do today because we have a hard time to access the prints or to access the restorations. And so I decided only to go for the good quality pieces. So there is much more on my list, but still I will add that in future when I have the chance. So
there's basically also a list of things that you are waiting for that they might become in one way or another available.
No, the good thing is that all of you now saw the shortest version of this film.
Second shortest. You said it's
second
one.
Shortest, yes,
second
true.
Shortest.
Yeah, Olaf saw the shortest version last year in October. I had one screening with the 98-minute version, which was, I added another minute.
It's a great minute. It's really worth it. And which was actually the minute you added?
It's I think 15 films I added, so it's in different places,
And so when you are basically...
At the end, especially,
So basically more stuff from 2017. Yeah. So when you basically were looking at this thing developing, was there something that you... It was there a moment when you were suddenly thinking, okay, I really did it, I basically have... the micro image of film history? Because what I find really intriguing, that's why I find it so nice to watch the film again and again, is that basically you see something like really an inner harmony. The inner harmony of film history, of it basically, when you can just edit random bits of pieces and they suddenly work as clusters, you understand that, okay, you look at the result of dozens and dozens and dozens of years of editing on a global scale that creates some kind of rhythm that you can put stuff randomly together and it becomes some kind of harmony, give or take?
Well, I think it's... What I like about this image is that it's coming from so many different, very heterogeneous images or movies or pictures or epochs or decades, but still it has its connection, its visual connection to each other, because we're basically looking at white dots on a black background. And sometimes they create the depth of space, which is infinite, and on the other hand, the next shot looks so flat that you are not... It's just a wall that we're looking at. And of course, understanding that scale of the idea, how can I put the whole thing together? I really like the notion that you can depict this 115 years of film history within and 1.5 hour film. So just to create, to understand those feelings or the soundscapes or how language changes, yeah. That was the most interesting part for me.
And why? Why?
Sorry?
Why?
Why? Because I think I wanted to find out more about the present. Because you can see in the 1930s, the people are singing in choruses towards the stars, and the idea is maybe to reach the stars so mankind unites. And in the 50s, you can feel there is a threat from the outside, which you can't really name, but it's a gloomy, spooky, spooky feeling that you have. And in the 60s, it's getting more colorful. And so we know these... the different colors and feelings or soundscapes of the different decades, but I didn't know the one from this decade.
Yeah.
So I'm still trying to figure out what is the commonness of today's technical parameters, musical styles, language, and I'm still learning from that by watching also this film. So I'm mostly interested from that perspective to see what mechanisms people are using. And, you know, the language was so authoritarian there was so much mansplaining in the 1950s. They really tell you what to think from A to Z. And then I was really surprised that it's only in the 1980s that people are not using that much acted voice, but a more colloquial friendship talk that is being recorded and also put in the film. It's very late. It's not even in the 70s. In the 70s, people are still really acting out their voices and really articulating their sentences. And I found that in these days still, or again, the voices are creating some kind of authority. And also the music supports that authority. And that's giving me a new perspective about today, and this is why I thought this is interesting.
Is there actually some star that you are that you have a big desire to have in the film?
Yeah, many older ones, because there is many gaps in the older films. So in the earlier cinema, so there is many beautiful depictions. For example, one I even got the rights for that for the. Now I spoiled. There is a starry night sky where you float into the stars, and one of the stars gets so close to the camera that it really crashes. But yeah, I have it, but only in bad quality. I couldn't put it in.
Yeah.
So this is one of those that you missed.
So when you, can you actually still watch a film in a normal fashion, or do you basically immediately...
Oh yeah, I love it, sure, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
No, I mean...
And I'm so happy if there is a starry night scene in it.
Yeah? But isn't this becoming a weird... I mean, as you say, you want to make the film longer and longer and longer. You might say it's really a lifetime's commitment. Is this something that you can basically then shake off? I mean, I'm still basically freaking out when I see a Hitler in a movie and I feel we need to write Norbert Pfaffenbichler. I've got another one. And so is this... I mean, you know that you basically changed your own life with making this film by committing you to one image.
Yeah, welcome to my last 9 years.
Yeah, well, I'm basically thinking about the next 90 years or so.
Yeah, let's see. No, I'm so I had a lot of time to think about that, and I still think there is lots of things to find out in this field, and why stop, you know?
So actually, how did people make most of these? Is there kind of a particular trend, a particular, let's say, dominant technique? Are there minority techniques?
Sure. So lots of those images are just a number of layers, which means a number of photographic images superimposed on top of each other to create that motion of star traveling fields. And later on, it all gets computer animation, CGI effects. Sometimes it's really a hole in a cardboard in front of a light source. And sometimes it's just some kind of cloth or, I don't know, yeah, some reflective surface, even stones or sands. I had a very beautiful example of a... it looks like a starry night sky in the beginning, and then the camera opens up the aperture and you can see it's actually... dewdrops on grass, so it was just a reflection of the little drops. And there is many very inventive ways to do it, and sometimes they are even so wrong. There is a nice episode about one film I used twice in this film, which is Titanic, because James Cameron made this one pan on the starry night sky when Leonardo is already dead down there, yeah, finally. Best part of the film. And although I like him, but not in that film.
I like the ship.
And so basically that starry night sky is so badly made that they just mirrored the starry night sky, so you can see the same constellation twice. And then they were being made fun about about that. So in the re-release, when he recreated the film in 3D in 2012, he used the accurate night sky from that time so to compensate.
Mm. So basically, did you actually also involve, let's say, because you don't have only fiction films, but also some documentaries, etc. Did you actually involve, let's say, specialists for these fields also in the research? I mean, NASA, etc.
Not
whatever
too much.
Austria has.
There's no NASA in Austria. forget it. They hardly have a budget for space travel at all, you know, for space research at all.
But you have a national epic that deals with space. 1. April 2000.
Ah, yeah, but that's a very funny special film. So I wanted to focus on feature film because I was... as I told you before, I was focusing on the interpretation of that image. So I did not include documentaries, but then I found, of course, in the course of my research, a lot of documentaries that have a very inventive way, let's put it that way, of depicting the starry night sky. So I included those special cases when it's very obvious that it's very made up. But I didn't want to include documentaries, straightforward documentaries, because then you would have... the professor talking about the constellations for hours, and this would somehow destroy my concept in a way. So I excluded those realistic starry night skies from documentaries, but I included all different ways of all different kinds of feature night skies.
And no animation.
I thought I cannot use animation,
but
in
I
the
think
first
I saw,
place.
I think you saw Cowboy Bebop.
Yeah. The thing is, animation is a special case because I thought they're too stylized and they would really pop out in the course of the film. And then I found out I was completely wrong, because the starry night sky backgrounds in animation are so realistic that you can't distinguish them from the real starry night skies, which are animation anyway. So I realized, wow, most of those... so there's two realistic things in animations. It's the starry night sky background and the audio, the voices. They're very conventional. And so I started to put them in, and those really big, chunky starry nights that you see in this film are from regular feature films, and those from the animations really blend in. So there is lots of animation, actually, in the film. Because, you know, they're also representing and especially also interpreting the starry night sky or that image.
So was there something that you discovered during doing this that you did not expect?
Of course, many, many things.
Name two. Name two, let's...
I was, I mean, the language, the way it changes was one thing. What else? Actually, I expected to come up with the same Starry Night image many, many times, but I did not. So I thought the people will use a lot of stock footage and just repeat the same image, but this hardly ever happens. And I guess that is because people don't want to pay the fees to buy the stock footage. So all the cameramen or special effects people say, yeah, I can do a Starry Night sky easily. And then you end up with those here. That was a surprise.
Did you actually talk to any people who did Starry Night skies?
Yeah, yeah. And it's beautiful and amazing what different stories they have. So some really take great care and spend nights in the desert to shoot and to come up with elaborate camera motions to make a beautiful image work, and others have other tricks. So it's really interesting.
Is there actually kind of a specialist for this? I'm really curious because you do have specialists, for example, for time. Time lapse, etc. Is there some kind of star image specialist?
I'm sure there is, yeah.
But you never?
No,
I'm quite certain you do have lots of questions. I knew it. Please.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the film. It was great. I just wondered why you didn't go backwards in time. Why did you go forwards? I mean, for me, I always thought that looking into space, you're looking backwards in time. And also, I have a more practical question about rights clearances, and did you pay for them and all that kind of stuff?
So for the rights, yes, I got many rights. I also asked many right holders and also filmmakers who are still alive who wanted to contribute to this film. But of course, with the number of films, I couldn't really do the whole extent. And going backwards is a fantastic idea. It's beautiful. But then also, you would end up at a certain point, which would be ideally the first moving images or the first the beginning of film history. And then it would be very specific about that. And also, it would be more confusing to go back in time. And I think it's more legible, or I think you can read the film better in the other way around. And also, then we have the open end and not the open beginning. So right now I like it that it ends today and we are being released in our present.
Okay, well, you could do another version.
You could do it.
Or just run it backwards.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions? Yes, there's a gentleman over here.
Great, thanks very much for that. I just wondered if you could say something a little bit more about the sound. How are you working with the sound? Because now that there's a lot of... you could have answered one question earlier, but with the title sequences, which I was kind of intrigued about how that was operating. So that answers one of my questions already. But how much of it are you designing, or how much are you relying on the randomness of the cuts with the image, because you have certain rules where you have to cut the film? And how are you treating the sound the same way, or is that...
Yeah, it was basically, I was editing the image only, and the sound came with it. So the sound is completely synced to what you see. I didn't take care of any sentences or words. You could hear that they were chopped up badly in many senses. Sometimes I had quotes which were really, really beautiful, but they were just before they look up in the Starry Night Sky. So I can still remember them when I see this film, but you don't probably. And anyway, I think it's still rich enough, and there is so many quotes, even if you only have half of the quote, that you can still... get really the impression, and also the geography of where the film was made through the languages, of course. And so I just treated it as a part, and really orienting myself on the image and to see what comes up without me making those choices, but with the concept of the image, creating those sound sequences, which I also enjoy very much. I mean, I really love the new melodies that emerge when you cut up these title sequences. Mm-hmm. And I try to be as faithful as possible, so the sound channel layout is also very accurate. So in the beginning, there is silent, as you could hear. Then there is mono, and then there is stereo and three-channel sound, some four-channel sounds, and 5.1. And that means in an acoustical way, it's also a history of cinema technology or of sound in cinema. So at a certain point, the subwoofer wakes up, and then we are in this soundscape of what is cinema for us today. And I liked that it's getting more and more channels are trying to fight for our attention and grab us. Yeah.
You got very lucky with some punchlines though as well. That,
yeah, some of them are just perfect. Actually, I'm always singing or reciting those in my head. Actually, I want to scream them out loud when I'm in cinema, but I don't for your sake. So.
Over there, please.
I really started to know this film by heart because I watched it so many times, and this is like.
So you actually can also sing the German chorus at the beginning.
Of course, yeah. And the thing is, now after watching it a couple of times, I already anticipate the next scene. So it's like when you hear an album of your favorite artist, you know at the end of the song what's how the next one starts. So I have this constant impression that freaks me out. In a good way. Hey.
Hi, yeah. Sorry. In passing, you mentioned that you saw this as a personal film. And I was wondering if you can expand on that a little bit, because I guess, you know, it's kind of like structuralist cinema. You wouldn't normally kind of see it as kind of objective. So if you could expand on this idea of it being a personal film, apart from the man hours you put into it, which obviously makes it quite personal.
Well, it's personal as it's, of course, depicting my situation or how I could make that. It's also very much, again, my perspective. Because, okay, I'm Viennese in the years 2009 until 2017 doing this film. And of course, this means we have certain technologies, certain databases that we can have access to. I obviously have a cultural background that I'm only half aware of, or nobody can be completely, I think. And also, I cannot escape that. So I think this is, of course, very much my perspective, and I try to expand it as much as possible. So I was happy to include, for example, many Japanese films, but I'm also aware that many cinemas, like African cinema or Indian cinema or even Russian cinema that I also could get hold of a bit, is still missing. So this is something that I had to accept at a certain point. I mean, I could even, you know, just research for another 10 years and still come up with an unfinished film that only shows a small piece of the cake that is out there. So I think this is, describing something about what is on our minds. So all the people that I asked for film excerpts, they, of course, came up especially with films from the recent years or recent decades, and the old cinema is not forgotten, but it's, you know, most of the films did not survive, and only few are accessible anyway. And so this is one of part of the personal film. And then, of course, I have my preferences. I don't like to make crossfades. I really like hard cuts. So this is when it's getting personal in a rhythmical way. So I told you about the love that I have for all these musical tunes that are jumping in and out of that. So this is, I try to be as neutral, but also I can't escape myself anyway. So it's, yeah.
One should say that one great, let's say, limit that you set yourself is the perfection of the image, because if we would basically go and forget about that, I mean, Russia would be no problem anymore.
Yeah.
Because that would be so easily accessible.
Yes, it's true, but at the same time, you know, it's extremely difficult with this image, where you have very faint stars, and then when you have only a quarter of the resolution, like DVD, then you don't see those stars anymore, and it would be really a shame, because then also the Russian films will look bad, and they never did. So I don't want to. I mean, it's a decision that you have to be aware of. Maybe I also try to provide it afterwards, but still say it. But the comparison would be too bad. You can't put VHS against 35 and pretend it's not there. And I would also always. I try to recreate as much as possible that original image, how it looked like on the screen. You know, it's a difficult thing anyway, and with VHS it doesn't work.
Any other questions on your part? Yes, over there.
Still not tired. Wow.
Cheers, thanks. Thanks for that. Have you ever considered using any, I mean, would you consider using any, like, image analysis techniques, like machine vision, like creating statistics on images, like the contrast and the number of, the proportion of white to black, and looking at how that changes over time, or is that, like, besides the point?
You mean of the finished film?
Yeah, just research. All the scenes, yeah. Or research generally.
For the scenes, yes, because in that form you can compare them. I wouldn't do it so much over with a machine or with an algorithm, but rather by comparing them by hand or by statistics, because it's still overseeable. I did not want to research with an algorithm because first you have to write the algorithm and then you come up with many mistakes or wrong images, and there's a lot of black images with white dots in films in general, and you have to really filter those, so you would suddenly end up with 10,000 of films or images or sequences that you have to filter through, and that doesn't make any sense for me, because then I really have to be a slave of my own algorithm, probably, that I have to, you know, bug fix all the time. And also, as I said, I prefer it to be more personal and more handpicked, although it's a statistic film at the same time, but I don't want it to just auto-generate, because then it would lose its soul, I think.
So we have got time for one more question. Who's fastest?
It's over, no?
No, I'm quite certain it's never over. There's always somebody. I know it's gurgling under the surface. It will explode. No. Oh, I knew it.
Yeah, really great film. I might not be able to phrase this very well, but I think there's something quite interesting about, like, the use of, like, your kind of, like, visual languages, which almost don't come across, because there's this idea of, like, the kind of, like, aesthetic which you're making, but then also the anti-aesthetic of trying to make everything really kind of regimented. And I was wondering, with, like, the what variables there are in the film which show, apart from the selection of the films which are being in it, your kind of, like, input into it. And I was wondering, like, with the chronological stuff, is it done by release date, or just, like, everything done in 2015 is in, like, a sorted order?
No, it's release date, yeah. So it's really the chronology is day by day. So it's really accurate historically. I didn't get the other part of the question.
Like, what different variables are there in the film which had your kind of, like, influence in it?
Variables.
I suppose things like your taste or your choice.
But yeah, okay. Yeah. I think I kicked out two film scenes where I hated the sound so much that I couldn't bear it. So I love really 95% of these Starry Night Skies so much, but some have such awful like indie rock band music that I have a hard time to cope with, and I still kept them in, but two of them were too hard, so I was like... No.
Titles?
I forgot them, luckily. Erased.
So, this was then the last question of the last movie of hopefully not the last SA Film Festival, and if you do have some questions that you want to ask Johan outside, because you are shy people and discreet people. As you see, he's a very, very nice guy, so don't hesitate to abuse his kindness with many, many questions. I thank you for your interest, and I thank you for coming,
Johan. Thank you for inviting me, and let's have a drink now. Yeah.